Hi, I'm Brandy Wilson.
And I'm Jessica Smith.
And welcome to Facts Matter.
So, in each episode, we will be discussing local and national trends in matters of public health, along with the research and evidence that informs harm reduction practices. We'll be doing this starting out about once a month. And the first few episodes, we're going to discuss just the basics of harm reduction, what it is, the guiding principles, types of harm reduction programs, and the history of drug policy. After the series of introductory shows, we're going to discuss the decades of history around harm reduction and how it came to be and the data that supports it. And we will also have some experts in the area of harm reduction on future episodes.
Thanks, Jessica. So we are from Humboldt Area Center for Harm Reduction, and that is a harm reduction program, syringe exchange, overdose prevention in rural Northern California. And we are located in Eureka, in Humboldt County. We are the only drop-in syringe exchange in Eureka, and we are heavily influenced, and many of our decisions are made by people who use drugs, as they are the experts in their own lives. And we'll actually discuss that a little later today. And we've been serving the Humboldt community since about 2014. Today's episode, we are going to discuss what harm reduction is, the principles of harm reduction, ways harm reduction has been implemented in the past, and some current work happening. We're using the definition of harm reduction by the Harm Reduction Coalition, and they're the large national coalition, and they really are the mothership of all of us other programs. We find this to be really one of the best definitions, and that is harm reduction is a set of practical strategies and ideas aimed at reducing negative consequences associated with drug use. Harm reduction is also a movement for social justice built on a belief in and a respect for the rights of people who use drugs. Now, the reason that definition is so critical in our world is the importance that it puts on the expertise people have in their own lives of using drugs, and that their voices are the ones that really should lead the policies and the programs around that. Do you have any? What do you got on that, Jessica?
So it's kind of actually related to some of the main harm reduction principles that also we kind of adapted from the Harm Reduction Coalition. But again, that big one is that folks who use drugs are kind of at the center. Their voices are the ones that are, you know, affecting policy and affecting the programs. And it's something that we, you know, make sure that we do in our organization as well. Our guiding principle is nothing about us without us. So really giving the most marginalized folks an opportunity to speak for themselves, speak about their experience, and create programs and policies that are really meant to help them directly.
And the nothing about us without us, we hold extremely, extremely dear to us. There is generally almost no decision made within our organization that does not include a major voices of the people who use those services, whether it be peers or our consumer base. But we really try and make sure that people's feedback of who use the program is heavily used to drive more services.
Mm-hmm. So beyond that main principle of centering the voices, and using the input of people who use drugs, we also follow some other harm reduction principles, including, understanding that drug use is a reality. People are going to use drugs. People have for a very, very, very long time used drugs. So we want to actually work to minimize its harmful effects instead of just ignoring them. some other principles also include that drug use is in fact a complex issue. It does exist on a spectrum from complete and total chaos to, you know, abstinence and then everywhere in between. And it acknowledges that some ways of using drugs are in fact safer than others. Harm reduction also takes a non-judgmental approach to providing services and resources to people who use drugs. And it again, you know, it affirms that the drug users themselves are the primary agents of reducing harm in their own lives and of their drug use. It also, harm reduction does not minimize or ignore the danger or harm of any kind of licit or illicit drug use. And it really does take an intersectional approach. So it acknowledges how different people's experiences and statuses of poverty, class, racism, previous trauma, all of these elements really affect how people are either vulnerable to drug use and how they, you know, may have more or less capacity for effectively dealing with drug-related harm.
Mm-hmm. So before we move on, I want to talk about, you know, we've heard a few times now of drug user voices being really one of the instruments leading decisions. So I think it might be important for us to talk about that for a minute, because that might be a piece where people kind of get hung up and say, but can they make good decisions? Do they really care? Well, yes. You know, just like any person, there's certain things you care about and certain things you don't. And, a lot of what's been done historically to address substance use has been done without any information coming from the people who use drugs. So, you know, administration in a recovery home will decide what practices, what blanket practices they're going to use. Many times not engaging with the people who are using those services. And so that's sort of where gaps begin. And silos happen, and that's where those cracks are. Those are the cracks where people fall through, and that's when people in the outside community start screaming, like, oh, these things are going on. Well, that's because we have some barriers to services, and we have some services that aren't really appropriate for the people that they're trying to reach. So one of the things that really helps eliminate that is
having those voices. having those people tell us what they need and what they want. And I don't know, maybe to just kind of ground it in sort of a way. So if you aren't a person who uses drugs, maybe sometimes you do things that you maybe know aren't the best for you. I know I go on sugar binges all the time and it's not the best for me, but it doesn't mean that I don't care about myself at the end of the day. It doesn't mean that I don't want to try to make better decisions, maybe just eat one cookie instead of six. So it's the same ideal. People who use drugs do want to be safe and they want to be as healthy as they can. And so, you know, telling people that they don't deserve that or they couldn't possibly care about themselves because they do this thing is just kind of inhumane, and it's not true.
Hear, hear. That's a really great note to move on to. Ways harm reduction has been implemented. So, in the past and right now, just some really basic things that we as human people do because life is inherently dangerous. When we go outside and it's very sunny, one of the ways we prevent skin cancer is by sunscreen and big floppy hats. We know the sun causes skin cancer, but we still see people sunbathing. We still see people enjoying the sun, and they just reduce the harm of that by using sunscreen. There's hard hats for construction workers. There's seatbelts. So seatbelts. We knowingly and willingly and many times decide that it's our right to drive a vehicle, which is a big metal box hurling our fragile bodies down a highway
really fast
at 60 or plus miles an hour. That is inherently dangerous. And up until recently, it was a bigger killer than opioids. Opioids have now surpassed that recently, but it is in our top three. So wear seatbelts, friends, because that's dangerous. Harm reduction works.
Mm-hmm. And as a person who consciously puts my body in harm's way by training to be on the roller derby team, I am very aware of the harm that I am putting myself in, but I choose to do it because it's fun and it's great stress relief. But we use lots and lots of harm reduction principles like helmets and knee pads and elbow pads and wrist guards and mouth guards and proper training so that we can be as safe as possible and know what we're doing so that, you know, accidents still happen, but at least we are taking the steps to make sure that we can be as safe as humanly possible.
And endorphins are great. Mm-hmm. They are really great, but a lot of times you have to do dangerous things to get a hold of them. So wear the protective gear, be trained properly, and educate yourself on those fun activities that might be dangerous. So those are just ways that anybody and everybody deals with harm reduction on their daily life. So there is some historical context about harm reduction. Jessica, will you share that with us?
Yeah. So before the historical context specifically of harm reduction, it's kind of important to have a grasp of the historical context of drug use and just how long drugs have actually been around. And so when we think about it historically, drugs have been used religiously, medicinally, and recreationally. Entheogenic drugs, or plants specifically, things like mushrooms, that kind of give you that altered state of, you know, disassociative, trance-like thing, they were being used at the center of religious rituals in Central Asia for at least 4,000 years. As far as medicinal use, opium has been used as a medicine, and is described in the earliest written records from Greece. And as far as recreational, some of the main drugs that we think of historically and now, alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine. All of those things have mild psychotropic properties and are commonly used now and historically. Abnormal patterns of substance use have been described since at least 323 BC. And even the definition of addiction has kind of been talked about a lot historically and has been changing. How we know the definition now, as far as like the medical definition, that's just come to us since the 20th century. So basically what the historical context of drug use shows is that it's complex. And if you have a complex issue, you want also something like harm reduction that has complex solutions and addresses the issues and potential harms using multiple methods, multiple understandings, so that, you know, as many people that can be are going to be affected in a positive way.
Why, thank you.
You're welcome.
I had a little note that when you were talking about opioids, this isn't the first opioid crisis we've had. In fact, it's about the third. At the end of the 18th century, there were a lot of opium dens. And when white women and younger white kids started frequenting opium dens, which were seen as filled with people of Asian descent, the system and the people that run the system were concerned that white women and white youth that were going in there were going to be tainted by this drug from another color of people. And we really need to remember the context of what women and young people were at that time. They were property. So during that time, and every time there's an outrage over drug policy, it seems to revolve around
breaking into the white community.
Yeah, it seems when white people start doing it, it seems to be a problem, or when it starts affecting their lives. So that was that one. Then in about 1920, there was a lot of opium being prescribed for quote unquote women's issues. The doctor would prescribe it for women's hysteria and pain related to menstruation. find that interesting. And then there's this one. And that, you know, this one has actually been going on for a very long time. People of color have been dying exponentially higher than anyone else. But it wasn't until middle-class white kids started dying that it became a crisis. And we're grateful that it's now being viewed as a crisis. I'm hopeful that in the future we can start addressing things in all communities and not just wait until middle-class white communities be affected. And it's not saying anything bad. It's saying something about our system and not those people, right? It's not. It's nothing against middle-class white people. That's fantastic that you have gotten to a space in life. We're just hopeful that drug policy and the system will start acknowledging all people and all people's issues and not just wait for a certain segment. So now it looks like we are going to talk about current work in harm reduction going on across the nation, and we might throw in some world stuff, don't know. And we're going to talk about what our program does as well.
Did you want to touch real briefly on sort of the history of harm reduction as it's, you know, where it started? Sure. And how it came about?
Yes.
As far in relation to drug use.
Today? Like, yeah. Like when the syringe exchange movement started?
Yeah.
So in the 80s, when the HIV outbreak started, is really when drug users and their healthcare professionals, this was happening in Brooklyn and on the West Coast, they would go out onto street corners with strollers full of syringes and start passing out syringes along with some conversation about what was going on with disease transmission within the injection drug use community. You know, there's been lots of battles over time through that, and those original people really fought for a long time, and some of them are still around and get to see that their work didn't just stop there, and that now, you know, there's syringe exchanges across the country, across the world, even in some countries you wouldn't think. Like, we know a wonderful person who ran a syringe exchange in Cambodia. And in fact, I think we'll ask her to be on here sometime because that's an amazing story. And so just as it is a pretty heavy battle here in our community right now, it was a pretty heavy battle then. Then the state of California authorized syringe exchange, but cities and counties were fighting against that, trying to make policies that would overrun the state's authorization for syringe exchange. Well, we know an attorney that was the attorney that fought those and really fought hard. There were a few attorneys, but we know one, so we're like, ooh, we like him. Really fought hard for those syringe exchanges, and while people were getting arrested, and they began to win cases and set precedent that the state can authorize syringe exchanges, and the state is an authorizing body and has a good amount of control over that. And we are very, very grateful for that in this community. And so that brings us to about current work. All right. Current work in this community that's happening in harm reduction is, there's a lot. There's our program, and our program is one of the only, it is the only drop-in syringe exchange that has a lot of other stuff, and I'll let Jessica tell you about that. But there's a project called the Raven Project, and they don't do syringe exchange, but they are for at-risk youth, and they really practice harm reduction a lot in everything they do, and we really appreciate what they've got going on because, you know, the more we can support youth, the less adults we may see enduring those same issues. Within our community, there is a coalition of people working to address the opioid issues. That's the RX Safe Coalition, and that's a very big range of partners. It's from medical providers to our community-based organization to a group of doctors, methadone treatment, child welfare, probation, coroner. It's really a countywide effort. Some of the segment of that work is specifically to reduce the amount of opiate prescriptions going out to Humboldt County residents. We can talk about that at a later show, because that has a whole, that's many layered. That's very layered, and a lot of policies have to be careful around that. So that's a whole different show. We are one of a couple syringe exchanges in this community. There is us, there is the county program, and they're fantastic. They have a van, and they can make it to the most rural parts of our community, which is really great because we have some of the biggest county sprawl of land, but all of our people are conglomerated in little towns throughout. So the county van really is useful. They have testing, they have navigators to PrEP and PEP, which is HIV medication and a prophylaxis. We also have medicated assisted treatment, so Suboxone, Subutex, and hopefully methadone soon. Open Door has been the leader in our community in that for a number of years, and they've been doing an amazing job. We just have a capacity. Our needs are far beyond their capacity because we have so much drug use, because we're such a rural, disconnected area that we just got lost. We got lost from the rest of the state, it seems. And then Aegis treatment providers, they're coming in, and their hope is to set up a methadone and Suboxone clinic with a hub and spoke model. So they'd have a big center, and then they would have small centers in more rural places of our community. Overdose prevention sites or safe consumption sites, those are not something we're doing here locally, but there is a statewide initiative. It's tabled currently. It hasn't moved or anything since last year, but that initiative is still out there.
San Francisco's working on some things around that right now. They're pushing really hard to get that working.
Their new mayor, London Breed, is very much an advocate about it and has stated we're doing it. The ask for permission rather than forgiveness, that's a very bold move on their part. I don't know that that's a move we would make, but I commend them for that, to provide a space so that people can connect immediately with medical care and not die. And they won't be injecting on the street, and the needles don't leave the spot, so it also lessens needle litter, if that's the issue. So yeah, Jessica, what do we do?
We do lots of fun things. So besides providing syringe exchange and all the, you know, the supplies to make sure that folks are using drugs safe and clean and sterile and all that, we also, like Brandy was saying, provide a drop-in space. Folks can utilize our closet. They can get food. We have conversations all the time about, you know, connecting folks to services, whether they are ready to go into detox or maybe they need, you know, they just need to see a doctor if they have an abscess or any other sort of health concern. We have a warm handoff model, which means we're connecting them to services right then and there when they say they have an issue, not just giving out phone numbers and saying, good luck, hope you make it. We really want to ensure that people are connected to the services that they need. We also do overdose prevention training. Anyone and everyone who wants to learn about naloxone or Narcan and how to use it properly, it's something we always give out to our consumers, and also have conversations with them, you know, if they've had to use it either on someone else or if someone used it on them, what was that experience like? How many doses did you have to use? Did, you know, did the ambulance come? Did everything go okay? We provide all different sorts of supplies besides just syringes. We do have a safe snorting kits. So if folks, you know, don't ever want to inject anything, but they are snorting their drugs, you can, you know, you can pass on bacteria and other infections through the nasal cavity if you rupture something and there's blood. All sorts of bad things can happen. This is actually something I didn't know until I started working here. I was like, oh my God, that would have been useful. Like, okay, college days. but yeah, so that's really cool for people to have that option. It's like, well, no, I don't inject, but do you have something else that I can do these sorts of drugs safely?
Money is dirty. Money is dirty. Yeah. And think of all the poop that might be on the money. And you can have like 100 million germs on a little
one speck of poop.
That's just not.
We have that poster in our bathroom. It always reminds me. Don't we only have 5 minutes?
No.
It's still recording.
Okay. Hopefully we can edit that. Just in case we can't edit that, it said that it had stopped, so that's where we're at.
But this is our first podcast. We're still working out some of the kinks.
Hopefully it lets us edit that up, but we're almost done, so we're not redoing this.
Also pipe covers, again, for folks who are smoking their drugs. If you don't want to pass your pipe around to someone who may have herpes, or any other thing, even if you just don't want to catch the common cold, it's nice to have your own item to put on the end of that pipe so that you're not sharing the same sort of fluids. We also have a special hour dedicated to women specifically, and we actually just had Planned Parenthood come and talk to a group of women about sexual health, about preventing domestic violence, basically any sort of issue that they had related to sexual health or just their lives, especially women who aren't housed and have to, you know, protect themselves and just keep safe. That was a really awesome thing. And Planned Parenthood actually scheduled us a whole block of time so that we can take 4 women to appointments to get screenings and get health checks. So that was really amazing and an awesome partnership that we hope to continue with Planned Parenthood. Other education, not just for folks that, you know, use our services, but the community as well. I've been providing safe syringe cleanup training so that when people are picking up garbage, if they come upon a syringe, they know how to safely pick it up and where to dispose of it. So kind of trying to demystify and deal with the fear that can be around seeing a syringe on the ground. We understand that that can be sort of alarming and, oh no, what do I do? But so, again, reducing the harm, supplying people with the right information, how to deal with that safely, because it really is, you know, it is possible to pick up somebody else's syringe and not contract anything, not get poked, and just, you know, be a good community member and pick up another piece of garbage, just like a bottle or a candy wrapper or whatever it may be.
Yeah, so I think that feels, we talked about a lot of things today. We should probably give you ways that you can find out more information.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the places, like the definition and the principles that we use of Harm Reduction Coalition, that you can look up at harmreductioncoalition.org. To find out information about us, you can go to our website,
which is Hatcher, HACHR707.org. You can also find us on Facebook, and I think in the information section below this, we will have some links or at least references to some of the articles that we referenced today, because facts matter.
Dun, dun, dun! Because facts do matter. And I think that brings us to a close.
I think so.
Thanks for joining us. Hopefully we will get better at this, and you will enjoy listening to the love of our work.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.